Hi there, this is Tim Lightfoot from the Huffines Institute. I want to take just a minute before we get to the podcast to tell you about a really cool event that we're having here. On March the 23rd, 2012, we're having Huffines Discussion 2012, and what we're calling HD2. If you remember from last year, if you've been with us that long, we had the Huffines Discussion 1 last year where we brought in 8 scholars in sports medicine, people that had big visions and big thinkers in sports medicine, and we gave them 18 minutes to tell us their big ideas and what they thought was coming. It was a great interaction that day. These talks are all at the lay level, so anyone can understand them and be with it. And so today, we're inviting you to come on March the 23rd to the Huffines Discussion 2012, 1 to 4 p.m. If you want more details, you can go to huffinesinstitute.org. Check us out. Check out the speakers we've lined up. They're just an incredible set of speakers, and you wouldn't want to miss that. In the meantime, here's the podcast.
From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. We exist to try to bridge the gap between sports science and the public and practitioners. Every week, we bring you leaders in the world of sports medicine, people that are doing really interesting stuff that are passionate about it, and we really like talking to those folks. And every week is a great week, as you know from listening to past podcasts, and this week, really, we are quite excited to have our first race driver on with us. You know, most of you know that have listened to the podcast for a while that this is the time of year when racing begins, and we always try to do something with that because race athletes are athletes, and they have interesting physiological requirements. And this week, we are pleased to have Mr. Charlie Kimball with us. Welcome to the podcast, Charlie.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Let me tell the audience a little bit about Charlie. They may not know your name yet, but they're going to, we think, right?
Well, that's the plan.
Yeah, Charlie races in the Izod IndyCar Series. He is currently driving the number 83 Novo Nordisk sponsored car. He started, as many racers do, in go-karts. When he switched over to open-wheel racing in 2002, he actually got in the car and won his first race and set a new track record at the time. He was the first American to win a British F3 race in 13 years. He was the first American ever to win an F3 Euro Series race. So this guy's fast. You put him behind the wheel of a car, and he goes. And so, Charlie, we're so thrilled to have you on the podcast, as I said, to talk about racing.
Well, thank you very much. It's I love what I do, for sure, and so as a result, I inevitably love talking about it.
That's cool. One of the things I see in your bio, that you were actually accepted to go into Stanford, to go to school, and instead you chose racing. Tell us why you chose racing.
Well, I got into Stanford for their mechanical engineering program. My father's a mechanical engineer, designed race cars. I was actually grew up for a few years as a young kid in Europe when he was working in Formula One, engineered at McLaren and Ferrari and a lot of the big names. And he actually helped design the car that won the 1981 or 82 Indy 500 with Gordon Johncock. So racing's been in my blood. And after getting involved with go-karting and then open-wheeled racing when I turned 16, I decided I either wanted to drive or design cars. So Stanford was that option for me as far as following in my father's footsteps, getting an engineering degree and working at the racetrack. Fortunately, they gave me a couple of years deferral, the opportunity to pursue my career, at which point, you know, I moved to Europe, and that's when my career really took off. So at that point, it was easier to turn down something like Stanford University for a college education and pursue my passion and continue my dream of racing cars. And the way I see it is I plan on going back to school and getting a college education sort of after I retire. mainly so that when my kids say, well, you didn't go to school, you know, when I'm trying to convince them to go to college, I've got a foot to stand on. Yeah. And looking back on it, if I go to Stanford or some other college, I'll get a great education, and maybe I won't study engineering because I will have lived it in the race car for so many years.
Right.
You know, maybe I'll study something else fun, some other math or science-based. As long as it's not English, I'm golden.
Well, I like the fact that you're doing a preemptive strike to settle any arguments that you have with your future children.
Well, that's, you know, I just keep thinking, what would have been my argument to my parents? And so, you know, both my parents have a college degree, so I thought, well, you know, if my kids bring that up, I've got to be able to have something to strike back with.
Yeah. And you kind of mentioned it a little bit, one of the beauties of racing at the level that you race at is you get to see the world, don't you?
I do, and it's something that I've always enjoyed, you know, having lived around the world as a kid, and then when I raced in Europe, you know, I got to travel all over the world. I've raced in Malaysia, Hong Kong, China, you know, everywhere, and so I really enjoyed the travel part of it. In fact, I'm on the road at the moment getting ready for the race season, and, you know, so I've gotten pretty good at trying to communicate via email and phone and text message and Twitter and Facebook and all of those, you know, while I'm in airports or in the car headed to an airport or at the racetrack.
Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, some of our listeners can hear the cars in the background, which is kind of cool. Cool background music for us.
Well, I felt very lucky this morning. There's some open-wheeled Indy Lights testing going on, and I got to sit out on the terrace, you know, and have a cup of coffee and send some emails and, you know, all of the background of race cars going around, and that's the perfect soundtrack for my life.
Yeah, and for many of us, it would be a dream come true there.
It is very special, and I really do appreciate it. There's so many days when I get up and think, you know, I'm so lucky and so blessed to be able to do what I love, and you know, and to at the same time I have the opportunity to hopefully help people and inspire people to continue to chase their dreams, you know, without setbacks, but then also, you know, in my particular case, you know, having gotten diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 2007. To be able to reach out to that audience and, you know, and show them that diabetes doesn't have to slow you down is very special to me.
Now, that's something I want the audience to understand, and that was a point that we were going to talk about, was that of all the race car drivers out there, I think you're the only one that's racing competitively at such an elite level that has been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes.
That's correct. Is, you know, I was last year in the 100th anniversary of the Indianapolis 500, I was the first licensed driver with type 1 diabetes to qualify for complete race in and complete the Indianapolis 500, you know, finishing 13th out of 33. Yeah. So to be able to break down those barriers is pretty incredible. You know, it's neat to be able to make my mark through racing.
Yeah, and you know, that wasn't necessarily an easy barrier to break through, was it? Tell us a little bit about what you had to do to prove to the sanctioning body that you could drive a car competitively for that length of time at that speed and not have diabetes interfere with that?
Well, the biggest challenge for me was believing I could do it. Before I even went into, you know, the licensing board or the medical review board or any of that sort of annual physical stuff, I needed to understand what diabetes meant for me as a person, as an athlete, and finally as an elite racing driver. And those sort of challenges, you know, I'm very fortunate. I work with a great healthcare team. You know, just like I've got a pit crew, I've got a health crew as well. They're three women out of USC Medical in Los Angeles. And she's, Dr. Ann Peters is my endocrinologist,
okay.
And she's worked with Gary Hall Jr., the Olympic swimmer who swims with type 1. So she understands the stress of competition, understands the stress of training and exercise, and without having a precedent, being the first racing driver, she sort of drew on all of her experiences from cyclists to runners to swimmers to mountain climbers and, you know, to prima ballerinas. to all of that to help give me the tools to be able to continue to drive. You know, I think I'm really lucky in that 20 years ago, I'm not sure I'd be able to do this. The technology has come so far, from the blood glucose testing meters to, you know, the continuous monitor that I wear in the race car. So just like I check speed and lap time and oil pressure, I check blood glucose as well.
You have that readout in your car.
I do. It's right on my steering wheel. So literally there's the car data and my body data all there in one eye line on my steering wheel.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
It is. And with the sort of the predictability and the science behind the modern insulins, you know, without them, I'd be lost. You know, I think it was recently, it was the 75th anniversary or something of Dr. Banting sort of developing insulin as a treatment for diabetes. And, you know, I've read a few books and read some history on him and his work, and, you know, getting to race in Toronto up in Canada, where he did a lot of his work in Ontario, is always pretty special, because my sponsor, Novo Nordisk, that you mentioned, they make the insulins that I use. So rather than it being an oil or, you know, a communications company or, you know, in the old days, a tobacco or an alcohol,
right.
You know, this is their product that's on the race car is something I use every day to manage my blood sugars.
Yeah. I would bet you're the fastest athlete that they have that uses their product.
Yeah, that's very true. And, I'm fortunate. They work with a lot of other speakers as well. And, you know, every year or so, we do a sort of a speaker training as an opportunity for us to get together and have a round table. And the organic conversations we have as athletes that have a basic understanding of each other and a foundation to work from because of diabetes.
Right.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, sitting around a table from Lightning Lou Brock, Kendall Simmons, who's won the Super Bowl 2 times, Jay Hewitt, who's run the Ironman 14 times, Marcus Dupree,
you know,
all of those guys, Will Cross, who's climbed the highest peak on each continent with diabetes. You know, we're talking about these moments in our lives as athletes that are, you know, special.
Yeah.
And, you know, for Kendall Simmons, it's doing snow angels in the confetti in the end zone after winning the Super Bowl. You know, and for me, it's driver introductions at the Indy 500, that moment when you realize that, you know, your life is very special, and we got to calling it the soak it in moment. And it was very special. And I wouldn't have had those conversations without, you know, my work with Novo Nordisk. And so not only do they they help me live my dream and drive a race car, but put me in a situation where I can just have those incredible experiences.
Yeah. Now, part of the preparation, as you were telling me before, is that it's not just your glucose monitor in the car, but you have, you know, if you become hypoglycemic, you have some things you can do in the car, and some of your pit crew have been trained.
That's right. Most drivers, especially for the 500, when you're in the car for three and a half hours, have a drink bottle. Typically, it's just a liquid bladder, almost like the Camelback systems that a lot of, you know, bikers and runners wear.
Yeah.
You know, and it's mounted somewhere in the car, hopefully away from the engine and the radiator, so it stays cool.
Yeah. Drinking hot stuff is not fun, is it?
Not during a race,
yeah.
No. And the tube runs right up and connects into your helmet. So in front of your face, you have the microphone so you can talk to the team, and then the drink tube so you can get some fluid if you need it during the race. Most drivers run, you know, a sports drink or a water-based hydration methodology.
Mm-hmm.
With me, it's a little different in that I actually have 2 drink bottles in the car. One I fill with, you know, ice water so that I can stay hydrated throughout the race. The other one, typically a smaller bladder, I fill with orange juice or another glucose-rich fluid. That's fast acting.
Yeah.
And there's a little valve mounted in the cockpit so I can switch between water and sugar water. I mean, just like you flip between hot and cold water at home,
yeah.
I can flip between those two depending if I need that glucose from the orange juice to bring my blood glucose levels back up. Because the challenge in driving a race car is that the physical exertion is such that if I haven't eaten, you know, enough carbs, or for some reason I'm more insulin sensitive that day, or whatever's going on, if my blood sugar, if because of the exercise, my blood glucose will burn off and that level will drop, I need to drink some orange juice and bring it back up.
Right, right.
And as you said, you know, my pit crew is trained in that if the orange juice doesn't treat me fast enough, during a pit stop, my inside front tire changer would change the front tire and then grab a syringe full of glucogen, which I'm not exactly sure of the science. You'd be able to help me a lot better than I would. But it, during injection, would release a lot of blood sugar into my bloodstream, and I'd be able to continue. Obviously not ideal, a long pit stop in the middle of a race, but it means that I'd be able to get back on track at least.
Right. Now we really have to say that now you've been using this system, what, for 3 or 4 years now?
Yep. I was diagnosed October 16th of 2007,
right.
And I've had four full racing seasons with diabetes, and knock on wood, I've never even needed the orange juice.
So never an issue at this point.
No, that's correct. And, you know, I like to take credit and say it's just me being awesome, but so much of that comes down to my healthcare team, the preparation, even the race team, jumping through the hoops of the second drink bag, of putting the valve in the cockpit, you know, the support crew, not even the guys over the pit wall, but, you know, the catering guys at the track saying, okay, what do you need? What, you know, how do you want lunch? When do you want lunch? Before the race? What, you know, giving me the tools so that when I'm in the car, all I've got to do is think about racing and winning.
Yeah. Now, you know, you bring up a point, though, that leads to a question that I always get from people when they know that I'm interested in the physiology of racing. They go, well, are these guys really athletes? They just sit down and drive. And I can sit down and drive for 3 hours, and it's not strenuous. What's your response to that kind of question or comment?
It's one that inevitably I got a lot in school, because they're like, oh, you race go-karts? That's not a sport. And they used to lump me and my friend who played golf together. You know, and I do think that golfers are athletes. I'm going to make that point first.
Yeah.
My response really is that driving an IndyCar for 3 hours is like wrestling a 2,000-pound machine with 600 horsepower under your right foot, with no power steering and an additional 2,000 pounds of downforce at speeds over 200 miles an hour with 32 other cars less than a foot away from each other all at the same time.
Right.
You know, and it's, I mean, it's not uncommon for racing drivers to do triathlons for fun, mm-hmm. because we're in such good shape, and it's so hard to train for racing. I mean, basketball players, when they're training, they go out on the basketball court and they shoot hoops.
Right, right.
Tennis players, pick up a racket, pick up a ball, find a net, you can go play. With racing, it's so cost prohibitive to be in the car enough to stay physically fit that in the gym, you have to almost overtrain, and not overtrain in the point of, like, injury overtrain, but train over and above what you expect you'll need, because when you get in the car, you have to have that excess strength to make up for the shortfalls that training in the gym can never get.
Right,
the G-force, 3, 4, 5 G's for a whole afternoon, your internal organs, you know, the muscles that hold those in place, it's not uncommon the first couple of test days of a year, you get out of the car and you feel like you've done a round with a prize fighter, because your core is just exhausted from holding, you know, your lungs in place.
Yeah. It always surprises me that NASA, for many years was concerned about the astronauts during liftoff because they experienced G's, 3 G's or so for about 15 minutes, and they were concerned what would happen to their performance levels. And I just continue to come back in racing, and you know, race drivers in particular are experiencing 3 to 5 G's for 3 hours. Four hours, and no one has stood up and said, wait a minute, we're really concerned about their performance, because it's just part of the job.
Exactly, and I think it's something that the, I mean, I'm continually astounded at how incredible a system that the human body is, but I think that the physiology catches up. Your brain acclimates to those loads, to that thought process. I mean, the first time, especially after the off season and having just done it, you know, at the beginning of winter testing, I can really relate freshly to it. But the first time you get in the race car, you feel like you're strapped to a cruise missile. You're so far behind the car that, you know, you have no idea what's going to happen next. But within, you know, half a day, you're up to speed, and pretty soon you're thinking ahead of the car, and you're like, man, they've turned the horsepower down, when in fact your brain has just sped up.
What kind of training do you do? This, since we talk about sports medicine and exercise science, is there any special thing that you do in your physical training program, especially since you have diabetes?
You know, the big thing sort of for motorsports, I'll address the motorsports side first and then talk a little bit about what diabetes brings to the table. But the motorsports side, we just have to train the whole body. I mean, we do a lot of shoulders, arms, you know, grip and forearm strength. We'll go to an indoor rock climbing gym and work on our grip strength over the winter. We do a lot of core work. We try not to do sit-ups as we do sort of balance work. I work with Pit Fit Training in Indianapolis, and he's trained champions. I mean, Scott Dixon went there or goes there currently. You know, James Hinchcliffe, the new GoDaddy IndyCar driver, James and I train together. You know, Jim works with drivers and pit crews almost exclusively, just physically training them. And we try and sort of work a lot on building foundational stuff, strength and core, and then building the cardiovascular and the reaction training. He actually has a DynaVision D2 light board that he uses in conjunction with intervals. So we get our heart rate into sort of operating zone when we're in the race car, above 160, above 165, jump off the treadmill and go straight into a reaction test. So that we can, the idea is that we can replicate or attempt to replicate some of the physiological cues of being in the race car. High heart rate, you know, under stress, straight into bringing the mind sort of back to focus and reacting to different cues. You know, we even did one over the winter where the board has red and green lights, and the idea was that you hit all the green lights because green means go, and you don't hit the red lights because the red means stop. So you not only had to react, but also rapidly process that information as well.
Well, and you bring up a point there. You talked about the high heart rates. It has been noted that IndyCar drivers in particular, they have heart rates generally between 150 and 170 beats per minute, usually expending somewhere about 87%, especially on the road courses, of their maximal capacity. So it's certainly a workout when you guys are in the car, and so you got to train for that.
Absolutely, and it's, I mean, it's not uncommon for us to lose between 5 and 10 pounds in body weight just in perspiration throughout the course of an event. You know, and you can't replace that just through a drinks bottle in the car. So when you get out, you know, it takes, I mean, I never sleep well the night after a race because of the adrenaline, because of the sort of my mind replaying the whole race all night, you know, and I never feel like I wake up Monday morning rested. But a lot of that is just my body rebuilding from the stress of a 2-3 hour competition that's at, like you said, 87% heart rate for 2 hours in a three-layer fireproof suit, typically during the summer in temperatures up over 80, 85 degrees.
Well, at least you don't have a roof on top, right?
That's the one nice thing.
230 miles an hour.
Yeah, people say, does your car have air conditioning? I said, well, we don't really have a top. It's just a 200 mile an hour breeze.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us a little bit. We're running a little bit close on time here, but I really want to ask you, since we have you on, what's the most thrilling moment for you? I mean, you talk about being introduced at driver introductions. Is there a time when you're on the track that you just think, oh, man, this is so cool?
It's, oh, man, just you asking that has given me goosebumps because that moment is so special. And I think the national anthem at every race, when you're lined up with your crew at the back of the cars, you know, flyover, that moment when you get strapped in, radio check, you know, 1 minute to countdown, when they hit the starter button on the back of the car and 600 horsepower come to life right behind you, you know, and you give it some throttle and then you roll out, that moment when they, you know, the engine turns over right behind you, it becomes very real.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's so special. And that's the moment sort of when I enjoy it, because as soon as we're starting to roll down pit lane, it's time to go to work. I mean, this is my job. That's my office chair. And so there's a moment where you go, okay, I absolutely love this. This is incredible. I'm very lucky to get to do what I love, but now it's time to go to work.
Yeah.
It's definitely a thrill. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding, as they say. And when you cross the finish line, be it a good result, a podium, a race win, when you see that checkered flag, you know, and everything comes to life because everyone's kind of holding their breath in pit lane, in the race car, until you cross that line. Then the radio comes to life, the pit crew's, you know, real excited. When you pull into the box or into the victory circle, you know, that's when it comes home again of how or why you do what you do, why you're sort of trying to bring it back to, you know, spending the time in the race car.
Yeah. You know, Charlie, I've just really enjoyed the time with you today. And we want to encourage people to watch you this year. The first race is, what, March the 25th?
March 25th, the Honda Grand Prix of St. Pete. It'll be live on ABC.
Cool.
And all the races this year will be equally split, or just about equally split, between ABC and NBC Sports, the old Versus Network.
Yeah.
The Indy 500, I believe it's the 96th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, is May 29th, I believe, Memorial Day Sunday, live on ABC. And if people want to keep up to speed with me sort of throughout the year and be a little behind the scenes on what a racing driver goes through in his everyday life, they can follow me on Twitter at RaceWithInsulin, or also on my website, charliekimmel.com. And there's a link to my blog, and I'll be keeping that more updated this year as I've sort of gotten up to speed with what life as an IndyCar driver is like.
Yeah. Last year was your rookie year in Indy, and you did great. You had a couple of top 10 finishes. And,
yep.
And your final finishing position was, what, 14th, I think?
Well, I finished 13th in the Indy 500. I think overall in point standing I was 19th, but we had some bad luck during the start of the year when I was learning, and I made some rookie mistakes. And you know, after the last few days of testing the new DW12, you know, the sound of turbos are back, and it's going to be a great season. I'm shooting for, you know, top 15 qualifying and top 10 in all the races.
And you've got multiple year sponsorship, so you're going to be around for a while.
It's nice to have a job for more than a year at a time, I'll tell you that. you know, I can't thank both Chip Ganassi Racing, and Novo Nordisk for all their support and the ability to put me on a race car, on a racetrack in a race car, and if you'll pardon the pun, give me a vehicle and a platform to tell my story.
There you go. Well, I will pardon that pun. You know, one thing that we give all of our guests a chance is, what's a take-home message? If there was something that you wanted people to remember from this podcast, what would that be?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that no matter what happens in life, be it a diagnosis of diabetes or something else, with, you know, hard work and perseverance, you can accomplish what it is you want to do. You can still chase your dreams and live your passion.
Great message. And a great message for us to end the podcast with. One last thing, we have the email question for the free podcast t-shirt. If be the first one to send us the answer to the following question, and you will win one of our nifty free podcast t-shirt. And the question is, what is the number of Charlie Kimmel's car? So send us that email at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win that T-shirt. Once again, Charlie, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate the time.
We've enjoyed it, and we'll certainly keep up with you, and we may talk to you again in the future. And I thank all of you for taking the time to download us and listen this week. We've enjoyed being with you and bringing another interesting viewpoint about sports medicine to you. Join us next week for someone else. And in the meantime, we hope you stay active and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Kelsey Sachs and Cheryl Marek and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, providing voiceovers internationally. Music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.